Hey everybody, it's Ben Greenfield, and I hope you are ready to talk about vegetables. I figured if we're gonna talk about vegetables in today's podcast, and not just any old vegetables, we're gonna blow your mind with some of these little known superfood vegetables and how a plant is like an upside down human and many, many other topics that I learned in a book that I recently read that blew my mind.
Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You gotta check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You can put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and your yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order. Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up, because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use this special form of a workout called a Rehit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's 5-minute workout just 3 times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office. My cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. carolbike.com. Well, if you're like me, you live a busy life. You don't really have time for many days off. That's why I talk so much about your mitochondria, because they generate about 90% of the energy your body uses, and keeping your mitochondria strong, it's one of the best ways to keep fatigue at bay. But these little mitochondria, darn things, are expensive to run. They use a huge amount of raw materials, especially when it comes to minerals. The problem is most people, including you and me, probably don't get enough minerals. And without minerals, your mitochondria don't have the cofactors they need to make energy. More than 97% of Americans don't get enough potassium. About 80% are deficient in magnesium. 40% are deficient in calcium. And those are three of the big ones. There's close to a dozen other trace minerals that are important for mitochondrial function, and most of us don't get enough of them, and you definitely can't get them from, say, table salt. It turns out that trying to take all the minerals you need by taking single mineral supplements isn't only hard, because you need a ton of pills, but it's not the most effective way to get your minerals. That's why I take liquid, humic, and fulvic complexes. These are full-spectrum mineral supplements, which means you get all the essential minerals your body needs in one go without a daily handful of massive amounts of pills or very large capsules or anything else that's hard to swallow. I use Beam mineral supplements, because they're almost 100% bioavailable. They come in a liquid form that's easy to drink. It's just 2 bottles. I keep them in my pantry, throw back a shot a few times a day. They're a great way to refill your mineral stores, especially for those of you out here who are haunting your sauna on a frequent basis, or sweating, or doing hot yoga, or anything else. Keep your mitochondria running strong. So if you want to up your mineral game, give Beam Minerals a try. Go to Beam Minerals, B-E-A-M, minerals.com, and use code BEN at checkout for 20% off your first order.
In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Show.
So that was a really key part of me being behind doing vegetable powders, because if they're not in a mirin jar, they're not worth doing.
So I would much rather give my patients, you know, Okinawan spinach as a diabetic medicine, along with low carbohydrate diet, etc., than give them the drug metformin.
I want to eat the food that looks the best, tastes the best, and smells the best. The cooked versus raw is dependent on the vegetable.
He's an expert in human performance and nutrition. Voted America's top personal trainer and one of the globe's most influential people in health and fitness. His show provides you with everything you need to optimize physical and mental performance. He is Ben Greenfield.
Power. Speed. Mobility. Balance. Whatever it is for you, that's the natural movement. Get out there. When you look at all the studies done, studies that have shown the greatest efficacy.
All the information you need in one place, right here, right now, on the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
Hey folks, it's Ben Greenfield, and I have to admit, it's not that often that I will read a book that is less than 100 pages long and still wind up folding over and highlighting nearly every page. It can be a source of frustration for me, I'll admit, when I read a book that's so jam-packed with information and I have the opportunity and the honor to be able to interview the person who wrote the book, that I just have so many things that I want to talk to that person about and not enough time in the day to do it. But today is one of those cases. I recently read this relatively small book called How and Why to Eat More Vegetables. And that's a book, of course, with a very simple title. But what I discovered was a really wide range, a very practical plant eating information that I really haven't seen published elsewhere, including things like little known superfood plants and why humans are like an upside down vegetable and how to make really nutritionally dense vegetable powders and a whole lot more. You know, one of those books that tends to present information that is tough to find elsewhere, which I love. And the book was written by today's podcast guest, of course, whose name is Dr. Tom Cowan, or it might be Cohen. Dr. Tom, is it Cowan or Cohen?
Cowan.
Cowan.
Cow.
Like the cow. There we go. And what we're going to talk about today is this topic of vegetables. And don't tune out if you think you know everything there is to know about vegetables, because I can guarantee you that you do not. And you're going to discover quite a bit from Dr. Cowan. Who is Dr. Cowan? Well, he is a doctor, of course, but also vice president of the Physicians Association for Anthroposophical Medicine and a founding board member of the Weston A. Price Foundation. And he studied nutrition, homeopathy, anthroposophical medicine, and herbal medicine. I'm going to have to ask you, Dr. Cowan, by the way, what anthroposophical medicine is and whether I'm even pronouncing that correctly. Dr. Thomas is also the author of the book, The Fourfold Path to Healing. He's the co-author of the book, The Nourishing Traditions Book of Baby and Child Care. And he lectures all over the place through the U.S. and Canada and around the world, specifically on ancestral nutrition and the healing arts, specifically when it comes to using food to heal the body. And he lives in San Francisco. So, Dr. Cowan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. And just one thing, it's fine to call me Tom. And just one minor correction is I actually am no longer the vice president for the Physicians for Anthroposophical Medicine. That was some years ago.
Oh, well, you'll have to remove that from your bio because there's lies being spread about you all over the internet. And that actually leads me to ask you the first question for today's episode, which I'm sure everyone is scratching their heads about. What is anthroposophical medicine?
So anthroposophical medicine is essentially, it means the wisdom of man, which is a pretty highfalutin kind of title. But the best, simplest way to describe it, it's the medicine that was inaugurated by Rudolf Steiner, who is perhaps better known by his inauguration and founding of the Waldorf School movement, which is the second largest private school movement in the world now, and biodynamic agriculture, of which, depending on who you listen to, something between 5 and 20% of the vineyards in Europe actually grow their grapes biodynamically.
Yeah, that's interesting. I actually drink biodynamic wine. I've had a podcast about it. You know, it's called Old World style wine, in which the filtration methods and the organic nature of the way that the grapes are grown actually is termed biodynamic farming.
Right. So Steiner was neither a doctor nor a farmer nor a gardener nor a pedagogy, school teacher, any of those things. He was a philosopher of Goethe, basically, by training. But he was a pretty gifted guy, and that's an understatement. And so he came out with essentially a way of seeing the world, and then he gave talks to different groups, like physicians or gardeners or farmers or, you know, school teachers. And that led to the creation of these different applications of his philosophy. So anthroposophical medicine is just the same philosophy applied to the practice of medicine, which I have studied, and I would say to a large extent branched out of, because there are certain things that I maybe don't exactly agree with these days, but it still has made a huge impact on the way I think about the world. And you mentioned the threefold plant, and that is a concept that's very central to anthroposophy.
Okay, got it. So it's basically almost like a holistic treatment of medicine, in which you're kind of trying to treat not just the disease, but the whole body. Would that be a way that you would describe anthroposophic medicine?
In a way, it's a little bit more specific than that. You know, Steiner had a very specific philosophy about, you know, how the world is organized, and the world, including the plant world and the human world. And out of that, and I can give examples if we want to get into that, but you come out with A, some novel approaches to medicine, or B, you can actually understand why, you know, historically people used chamomile flowers for stomach aches or things like that. You take it out of the realm of, well, those people must have done it by trial and error, which is not the case. A kind of a imaginative understanding of the world, which Steiner in some ways recreated. And so we can start to understand, at least from his point of view, how the world is organized, and therefore what we can do about it to make it better for us and plants and animals and everybody.
Okay. So not to press this matter too much, but let's say I walk into your office and I have, say, a sinus infection. How would one be treated anthroposophically for something like a sinus infection, and in contrast to like the alternative medical treatment of let's say, I guess like an antihistamine or something like that?
Right. So there's two options I could do now. I could just rattle off the things that I would do, or I can give an explanation of why, which I think is more fun.
Sure.
Let me do the second. So in the worldview of Steiner anthroposophy, the world of the plants and the world of the human beings are organized in a threefold manner, which is to say that your head or the nerve sphere is a sphere, and then you have the chest, which is between the head and the diaphragm, which is a transitional area. So the head, and then we have the heart and the lungs, and then we have the metabolic reproductive system in below the diaphragm. In other words, the abdominal organs, the metabolic system. Now, the first thing to note about that is the plant is exactly the opposite. So the roots, which are the sensing organ of the plant, in a sense, is always actually a sphere, even a carrot,
Okay.
We look at the whole plant system, and its job is to sense the environment it lives in. And then it has a breathing and a circulation, which we call the stem and the leaves, which correspond to the heart and the lungs. And then it has a reproductive metabolic system, which we call the flowers and fruits. And the first thing that's of note is a lot of the plant medicines for the heart, the primary example is digitalis, is actually from the leaf and the stem. So you can see that when you give a leaf and stem preparation, it improves people's breathing and circulation, i.e. digitalis is an example.
And what is digitalis?
Digitalis is a conventional medicine. It's been used. It's the primary heart medicine for hundreds of years, and it's basically a leaf preparation.
Okay, so that comes from like the leaf stemmy area of the plant, and what you're saying is that because that's the middle part of the plant, that's a medicine that you would apply towards the middle part of a human, like the breathing, circulation, lungs slash heart portion of a human.
Exactly.
Interesting.
So you can also there's different functions of the, like the nerve system, the head is supposed to be clear and cool and still, whereas the metabolic, which is also correlated with the limb system, is where the heat and the activity and et cetera come from. They even have three different, the three fluids of the human being, like the cerebrospinal fluid is crystalline, still, and clear. That's the nervous system. Then we have the blood of the heart and the lungs. And then we have the lymph, which is, you know, full of proteins and sulfur, et cetera, is in the metabolic system.
Okay.
So when somebody has a sinus infection, from an anthroposophical point of view, they have too much metabolism in their head. The head is supposed to be clear and cool and still. And sometimes I say, if people don't believe me, spend an entire day moving your head back and forth all day. And obviously that doesn't feel good because the head doesn't like movement and it doesn't like pus and it doesn't like sulfurous fluid. And when that happens, for instance, we call it a sinus infection.
Uh-huh.
So you have to essentially move the energy down into the metabolism. And you can do that with a medicine, for instance, that stimulates the bile flow. The bile flow essentially makes things move down. And the classic example of that is an herb called golden seal. Huh. So golden seal stimulates the bile. It looks like bile. And that's
like a dark orangish color.
Dark orange, yeah. Uh-huh. Bitter fluid, which stimulates that drainage. In, you know, Chinese medicine, they say you drain the swamp. So you drain the swamp of the sticky metabolic fluid in your head, which is what we call a sinus infection, and that restores balance, which is essentially the definition of health.
Interesting. Okay, so if we follow this analogy of a plant being kind of like an upside down human, what you're saying is the middle part of the plant would be like the middle part of a human. The lower part of the plant, which would be like the roots, would be the part of the plant that would be most beneficial for like the upper part of the human, right? Like the head or the neck area, and that would be like underground roots, tubers. I guess even what about things like, you know, carrots and potatoes,
yes,
and things like that? Would those be considered nourishing for the head?
Right. And in fact, that comes out in science and in folk medicine. For instance, everybody knows, not everybody, but that you eat carrots to nourish your eyes.
That's true.
So that's a classic example of a plant. See, the plant is supposed to be, or the so-called imaginary or perfect plant, should be equal in those three spheres. In other words, the color should be in the flowers. But a carrot, being an individual with a unique personality, says, no, I'm not going to put the color in the flower like a normal plant. I'm going to put all the color in the roots. I'm going to put all my, say, color energy, metabolic energy into the roots, which number one allows you to predict some interesting things, like that the color of a carrot flower is going to be white. Why? Because the color is in the roots. It's got no more color energy or whatever you want to call it to put it in the flowers.
Yeah, it's a good point. And although, what about, you know, and not to play devil's advocate too much here, but what about plants, you know, like I have a Oregon grape growing outside my house, which has dark orangish yellow roots, very much like golden seal. As a matter of fact, it acts biochemically, I believe, a little bit similar to golden seal in that it can be helpful for colds and flus and things like that. But the grape itself and the leaves are like dark green, and the grape is like a bluish purple, and you know, it seems colorful both on top and down below as well. How do you correlate that to the fact that like a carrot has a white flower but a colorful root?
I would correlate that, it's a great question, by saying that plant has decided to do color everywhere.
Okay.
The plants are like their own special beings, which we have to learn to read the book of nature. We don't have to, but that's the job of a doctor, as far as I can see. So that plant is telling you, essentially, I'm all about color. Not only am I all about color, I'm going to put my color in every part of the plant, even the parts that really are not supposed to be colored, like the roots. Okay. And so you might end up with a plant that actually addresses, you know, because colors suggest there's an anti-inflammatory role. You know, we know even the chemicals that are correlated with these colors. So that plant might have an anti-inflammatory role for the entire human being, which Oregon grape to a certain extent does.
Interesting. So it would be a very powerful plant. So we've got the top part of the, or I'm sorry, the bottom part of the plant being good for a human's, you know, like head, upper body area. The middle part of a plant, like you talked about with the leaves and the stems and things like that, being potentially good for, you know, like the heart and the lungs and areas like that. Now, what about for that third part of a human that you brought up, like the reproductive sphere, that, you know, the gonads and the area down in the crotch, like what area of the plant would be good for that section then? The very top area?
Yeah. And so we're not the top area. So we're talking about flowers, fruits, and we're talking about seeds. And then we're talking maybe even about the oil in the seeds. Hmm. So the plant makes oil usually in the seeds, which is the warming part of the plant. So that correlates with the part in the human being that generates warmth, which is the abdomen, which is why, you know, Japanese, they don't put their big bun on their head to keep their head warm. Like, that's not right. They put their thing, whatever that thing is called, on their abdomen to keep their abdomen warm. We use hot compresses, castor oil packs, hot packs on the abdomen, and a cool pack on the head, not the other way around. And that's correlating with the coldness of the root and the warmth of the flower and the seed.
Interesting. Now you get into this stuff in pretty hardcore detail in your book, The Fourfold Path to Healing. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Cool. I need to add that one to my next list to read. Cause you talk about this a little bit about how plants are like an upside down human in this book that I read that gave me the impetus to get you on the show today, the How and Why to Eat More Vegetables book. But it's really a fascinating concept. It sounds a bit woo, but it does make sense in that, you know, we talk about, what's it called, the signature of nature, where like walnuts are good for your brain, or avocados are good for your testicles, and, you know, nature gives us clues, like, you know, celery and carrots, I suppose. I've heard that they can be good for, you know, erections, and there's all sorts of interesting clues that nature gives us, and I suppose this is just kind of like an extension of that.
Yes.
Super interesting. So in terms of where you got started looking into all this, let's back up a little bit. I know that you spent a lot of time in Africa learning a little bit about how traditional ancestral cultures ate over there. What brought you over to Africa in the first place?
You know, it was basically, I would say groomed and grew up to be a doctor, and I didn't like it because I didn't like how medicine was practiced. I didn't like how they thought. I didn't like the philosophy, et cetera. So as soon as I could graduate from college and get out of there, I wanted to do something to see if I could do something besides being a doctor. I was already very interested in food, so I decided to join the Peace Corps and teach gardening in Africa, and that's how I ended up in Swaziland.
So you at that point already had a little bit of a background in gardening if you're going over there to teach gardening?
I would say a little bit. I learned when I was there from one of my students named Patrick, actually. And actually, the town that I was sent, not really a town, it was a village. It wasn't even really a village. The only other expatriate person within 50 miles actually was a refugee from a biodynamic gardening in Rhodesia at the time. So the first real gardening I did was biodynamics with Chris.
Interesting. Okay, got it. So you also mentioned that you were groomed to be a doctor. What do you mean by that?
I mean, my father was a dentist, and most of their friends were doctors, and it was always like, Tommy's going to be a doctor, without really asking me, because I was part of it.
But got it.
I got the vibe from them.
Okay, so you spent a couple of years over in Africa living with what's called a Swazi family. What's a Swazi family?
Swazi live in extended families, although the family that I lived with, he was the chief of the village, and he, interesting, made a remarkable decision to only have one wife, which, because he said, that's enough. And so I lived with them and basically ate with them most of the time for the 2 years I was there. And that's where I really had firsthand knowledge of what a traditional diet really looks like. Although that was a very modified traditional diet. It's not really what I would call an ancestral diet, but the components were still there.
And what are the components?
Well, my contention is that the components, if you look at whether it's a paleo or a Weston Price or whatever, there's three food groups if you look at diet properly.
Okay.
The first is animal foods, which are full fat, local, you know, wild fish, free range buffalo, insects, grubs, eggs, pigs, whatever you can get that's local, full fat, properly grown, etc. And I would also contend that because of a lot of factors, we now have similar animal products as traditional people did. You know, you can get grass-fed meat and wild fish, and it's not quite as good as 1,000 years ago, but it's pretty good. So that's food group one. Food group two is what I call the seeds and nuts group, which is everything from tree nuts, acorns, pine nuts. That was the traditional seed food of Native Americans. And then on up through more modern, you know, non-hybridized, like ancestral, even perennial grains. And so that's a whole separate group, which, you know, we get proteins and fats from the first. We get, you know, carbohydrates and certain fiber and other nutrients from seeds and grains. And all traditional people had some of the second group in their diet.
Before we turn to the third group, you'll see, for example, like in paleo circles, that grains and beans are, you know, they're the forbidden evils. But you're telling me that those are part of an ancestral diet?
What I'm saying is the seed category is part of an ancestral diet.
Okay. So, and when you say seed, you're including things like grains and quinoa and beans and things like this?
Yeah, but I'm also including things like nuts and seeds.
Okay, gotcha. So what's your take on grains? I mean, do you consider grains to be healthy? Do you consider them to be like defense mechanisms of plants that are harmful to the digestive system? Or, you know, what did you discover in South Africa? Or what do you consider yourself to be kind of like the take on healthy grains?
Fundamentally, I personally, and with my patients and what I write about, I would like people to be able to eat everything, but not everything like McDonald's
and or deep-fried Twinkies.
Right. And there are a huge number of my patients who I put on a sort of a classic paleo diet without grains, because it helps them rehabilitate their health and their specifically their gut flora. So there is definitely a case to have people do grain-free, bean-free, more of a classic paleo diet. And I do that. I do think, though, that when people are better, that trying the traditional grains like quinoa and, you know, wheat before it was hybridized, and traditional, you know, Hopi blue corn, that's at least a possibility for some people.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm on the same page as you, I believe. Are you speaking at the Weston A. Price Foundation conference, by the way, this year? Okay. Yeah. I'm going to be speaking there as well. And I would say that, you know, from the excellent cookbook Nourishing Traditions to a lot of the teachings that are put out by the Weston A. Price Foundation, I'm kind of on the same bandwagon as you, I suppose, in that if it's a real food that my great grandparents would have recognized, for example, I'll eat it, right? So we have goats and we do the milk from the goats. And my wife purchases like a local red wheat berry, like a non-GMO red wheat berry from the Palouse, and makes bread. But at the same time, you know, I've run into a lot of people whose guts would be destroyed by even, you know, raw dairy from a goat or my wife's sourdough bread because they've got leaky gut or gut inflammation from years of food abuse. And so they have to eat like a restricted diet, you know, like a, let's say like a paleo autoimmune diet or something like that, until they get to the point where their gut has kind of like been restored to a level to where it can handle the more intense workouts of the digestive system, so to speak. So I'm on the same page as you.
That's what I would say.
Okay, cool. So we've got the first component being like your ancestral meats, your animal meats, you know, organs, fat, marrow, all those type of things. The second component being maize, corn, grains, beans, seeds, nuts, etc. And then what is the third component?
And the third component is, I think, the one that is the most misunderstood, especially by the paleo community. And that is plants, meaning vegetables and fruit. And of that, it should be about 80% vegetables, about 20% fruit. And what I discovered from A, living with the Swazis, and B, then reading about it, like a book called Tending the Wild, which is about the diet of Native Californians, is that the traditional plant vegetable part of the diet included about 120 different plants per year, and somewhere between 15 and 20 per day. And of these 120 or 15...
Wait, 15 to 20 different types of plants per day?
Per day.
Wow.
So I heard about this almost 40 years ago, and the plant types include the threefold plant, you know, roots, leaves, and flowers, fruits. It includes all the different colors, so red vegetables, green, yellow, et cetera, purple, white, and wild vegetables, perennial vegetables, annual vegetables, all the different kinds of diversity you can imagine. So being who I am, which is kind of a food nut, I decided, you know, 30 some years ago with my gardening knowledge to eat 15 to 20 different vegetables a day and perennials, et cetera, and 120 a year. And I can tell you that it was kind of a big job and a kind of unsuccessful, because it's just hard to cook 15 vegetables a day.
Yeah, that's why God made the Vitamix.
Right, right. So, but I kept plugging away and growing, you know, more perennial vegetables, tree collards, ashitaba, genura, sea kale, perennial walking onions. So, and you know, trying to get wild vegetables, foraging, and it just was, it wasn't a doable model for people, even for me. And if it's not doable for me living in California and having garden access, it's not doable for the masses by any means. So
you mean it's just not doable from like the labor required to actually go out and find out dozens and dozens of different types of plants that you could put into your body each day? It's just too much time.
Too much time. And even if it, you know, I got convinced that perennial vegetables like tree collards or ashitaba, they actually mine the soil. They get more nutrients. They have better defense mechanisms. So they have better phytonutrients and protective chemicals. But if I told
what do you mean? You mean perennials versus annuals have higher nutritional content?
Yes.
And is that because the perennial, if I understand correctly, and I'm not as much of a gardening ninja as my wife, but these are the plants that you plant and they continue to grow a harvest year after year rather than needing to be replanted. And so they grow more hardy and more nutritionally dense and higher in antioxidant content, et cetera, from year to year.
Yes, exactly right.
Okay, got it. And you used a lot of words and descriptions of plants there that I actually haven't heard of. I know you get into a few of them in the book, but were there specific perennial plants that you found to be like extremely nutritionally dense, like the 80-20 of the vegetable world?
Yeah, like tree collards and this one called Ashitaba, which is called tomorrow leaf, and one called Okinawan spinach. Not that annual vegetables aren't nutritious, you know, and especially when you're looking for different plant parts, roots, leaves, and flowers, different colors, etc. The trick was to get all from all of that spectrum, different colors, different parts, different growth habits, annuals, perennials, all in a daily diet. And most people just can't do it because even if I told them to eat perennial vegetables, there's nowhere to find them. They're not available in the Bay Area. And so that was the dilemma that I set out to solve, basically.
Okay, got it. And I want to talk about that in a little bit, like how you figured out how to prepare like vegetable powders and things of that nature. But I actually want to ask you about this one vegetable that you mentioned, Ashitaba. I found that one fascinating in the book. Can you explain what the perennial vegetable Ashitaba is and how somebody would eat it and why you consider that to be one of the vegetables that you really devote a lot of time to in the book?
So Ashitaba is called, another word for it is tomorrow leaf. And it's always interesting to look at these names of these different plants because they often tell us a lot. And it's indigenous to Japan and the Philippines, but we have it growing in our garden in Napa, and a biodynamic friend of mine also is growing it for us. You know, plants are gestures. They're living beings with their own story to tell. So the Ashitaba is a member of the Angelica family, of which its famous cousin is Angelica Archangelica, which, believe it or not, means the gift of the archangels to the angels. It was a very revered plant in the middle Europe in the Middle Ages. It supposedly was the only medicine for plague and other infections. And Ashitaba is a relative, a cousin of that. Archangelica is way too bitter to eat, but Ashitaba has a more celery-like taste. So the first thing is, it's, you know, if you do a nutrient profile like manganese, magnesium, B6, etc., it's about twice as much or so than kale. So just on a running a nutritional analysis, you would say, wow, this is, you know, kale is not that I have anything against kale, very nutritious vegetable, but it's not like Ashitaba. So that's the first thing. But the second thing is looking at the plant as a gesture. And why does it call tomorrow leaf? The reason is because if you cut off a stem, tomorrow you'll have a new leaf growing in its place.
Really?
And so it has this incredible vitality, which means it's like a lizard. You know, you cut off its tail and it grows a new tail. So you cut off a stem of tomorrow leaf, and tomorrow it has a new leaf. So the question that I would pose to Ashitaba, if it could talk, and it does talk in its own way, is how do you do such amazing vitality and not get cancer? Like, how do you have such robust cell growth, but you're able to control it? Because obviously the plant doesn't get cancer.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so the answer is, it puts this yellow sap in its stem, which has a chemotherapy drug in it. which, really? As I say, if I was the plant, that's what I would do. I would say, it's good to have good vitality because then you can grow like crazy, but you got to control it. So I'm going to put a cell differentiating substance, which is called calcones, C-H-A-L-C-O-N-E-S, into the stem. So my increased vitality goes into producing a new Ashitaba leaf, not a undifferentiated cancer growth.
Wow.
And so when we eat the Ashitaba leaf and stem, which when we make the powder, we powder the leaf and the stem, and we get this yellow fluid, and actually, if you go on our website, you can see the oozing out of this yellow fluid from the stem. So we're giving people increased vitality and the chemical slash energy to control this vitality into a healthy way. And so that's an amazing plant.
That's really cool. You talked about one other one. I think you said it was called Okinawan spinach.
Yeah, there's another one called Genura procumbens, otherwise known as Okinawan spinach. And that one has a different story to tell. And that one is more of a biochemical story because it has a substance in it which produces an almost identical effect as a diabetic drug called metformin, which means it helps with the metabolic syndrome, it lowers blood sugar, all the things we try to do with a low-carbohydrate diet. And again, I'm all for low-carbohydrate diets, but when you add Okinawan spinach, you're protecting yourself against essentially, you know, the metabolic syndrome. So one could also say, well, why not just take chemotherapy drugs and why not take metformin? Mm-hmm. And, you know, my whole career has been saying with the theory, and I don't know if I can prove it, but I certainly believe it, you're always better eating Ashitaba or Genura than you are taking metformin or, you know, chemotherapy vincristine. It has no side effects. It produces more, it's more health producing rather than having a toxicity. So I would much rather give my patients, you know, Okinawan spinach as a diabetic medicine, along with low carbohydrate diet, et cetera, than give them the drug metformin.
But when you concentrate something that's good from a plant, sometimes it allows you to get more of that concentrated chemical than you would ever be able to, like, physically be able to get from a plant without doing damage to yourself, right? I mean, like wine, for example. Resveratrol is really good for you, but you would have to drink copious amounts of wine and produce a bunch of acetaldehyde and ammonia byproduct and all sorts of nasty stuff to be able to get all that resveratrol. Or you could try to get it from red grapes, but you'd have to eat copious amounts of fructose sugars to be able to get as much resveratrol as you'd want to get if you hadn't, like, concentrated that resveratrol into, say, like a supplement or a capsule or something like that. Where do you draw the line in terms of, like, choosing to do the whole plant food versus the extract from the plant?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And the answer, as a doctor, because I treat people with diabetes, it's fairly simple. We do the diet and Genura, and there's other plants that have similar effect first. If that works, we're good. And if it doesn't, we have to think about metformin or some other, you know, alpha lipoic acid or some other concentrated thing. But that's never the first option.
Okay, got it. Now, what about the actual nutritional density of some of these vegetables that you talk about? Can you kind of compare and contrast the density and why the density would be greater in, say, like a traditional, what you call a food forest versus modern agriculture? Like what is a traditional food forest and how does it differ from the way that we get a lot of our plants and vegetables nowadays?
Right. Which gets into this question of why I think the paleo people have the vegetable part wrong. So again, they have the animal food right and the seed part right. They eat nuts and seeds. The plants are supposed to be 15 to 20 a day and 120 a year, and perennials, et cetera. And you have paleo people now eating, you know, broccoli and romaine lettuce as their two main vegetables, which neither of which were even around before the, say, 1800s. So those are not paleo foods. Those are modern hybridized foods.
Really? Broccoli is a modern hybridized food?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know when it was first, quote, created, hybridized, but not in the paleo period.
So broccoli is like a food that's been genetically created?
Not genetically modified. It's been hybridized in the traditional way that, you know, farmers select. Yeah.
Plant breeding, based selective plant breeding to create some kind of a new plant.
Right. Okay, I have nothing against that. I eat broccoli. I eat romaine lettuce. I plant it in the garden and we grow it and sell it as powders. But so the first thing is we're always looking for, you know, the beet that came before the modern beets. So, you know, we try to look for beets that have been around for thousands of years, the same varieties. We look for, you know, Hopi blue pumpkins that are, you know, I always figure the Native Americans knew the most about pumpkins, so I'm going to grow the pumpkins and put those in our powders as opposed to modern, you know, selected pumpkins. The nutritional density is stronger, et cetera. And then to get to your question, you know, modern agriculture is about choosing the varieties that work the best for modern processing and, you know, in monocropping, which creates disease problems and lowers nutrient density. And what you really want to do is grow the most nutrient dense, which are the most flavorful and the most nutritious, often the hardiest. And you want to grow them in groups so that they all help each other do as well as possible.
So you would take a bunch of wild plants that you've researched to be plants that haven't necessarily been bred for, say, like sweetness or high yield crop or beauty, and perhaps like the ugly, more bitter versions of wild plants. You would hunt down these perennials that you talk about in your book. You'd plant those in a garden or on your patio in, like, you know, like a vertical tower structure or something like that, and you would plant them all together so that they're helping each other to grow.
Yes. And that's, you know, it's not like you have to go out and hunt out the wild ones. I mean, there's actually people who do that. And, you know, you can grow it in a whole variety of ways. But yes, you're exactly right. You know, that's the way of the future of gardening for taste and nutrient density, not ease of storage and because it has more sugar than the other one.
That's the crazy thing is, like, you don't notice until you start eating real wild plants how sweet the more modern plants are. I mean, everything yes. from, you know, kale to tomatoes. Like actually last night, and I did this because subconsciously I know I was going to be interviewing you today, but I took my kids on a plant foraging walk. And yeah, I know that not everybody listening in has, you know, access to nature out in their backyard, out their front door like I do. But we went out and we got a bunch of greens to make a salad. So we found a spot where the deer had been bedding and there were giant stalks of wild nettle out by where the deer were bedding because the deer loved to chew and eat the nettle. So we got a whole plastic bag full of nettle and then we had another little plastic bag with us that we reached down and we picked a bunch of plantain. And I taught my kids to grab all the plantain that had been chewed a bit by the insects because it releases antioxidants as like a defense mechanism when it's been, you know, eaten by predators. And so we had plantain and nettle, and then we gathered a bunch of wild mint, which has like a almost like a bittersweet flavor compared to, you know, say like the peppermint that you'll find grown or sold at say like the grocery store. And we took all that back and, you know, we dressed it with avocado oil, and then we added some salt and a little bit of raw honey and some feta cheese and some pumpkin seeds and made a salad. But you could taste when you eat the salad that bitterness. It's almost like you have to eat the salad more slowly because it doesn't taste as sweet as say like an iceberg lettuce or a romaine lettuce or even like a modern kale salad. But the nutrition density is through the roof. The antioxidant density is through the roof when you're eating like a wild plant like that. And the cool thing that I like is that I didn't have to do a thing. Like in that case, we didn't go out to the garden or anything like that. We just walked out in the forest where all this stuff was growing for us without us even having to tend it or to care for it. And so it's mind-boggling not only how simple it can be to forage for some of these plants, but also how much more nutritionally dense and how much more like bitter and less sweet and less pretty they actually are.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. And then you can recreate that. You can do that. You can also recreate that to a certain extent in a garden setting. And then you make it actually doable for people these days to have access to the kind of diversity that you had last night.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And I want to talk about the diversity a little bit because I know you have special methods of creating like these plant powders that you've hinted at a couple of times. And I've tried some of those as well. And you even have a recipe in the book for how to make your own. I want to pick your brain about that in a little bit. But I want to also delve into the energy of some of these plants. Like, you know, I try personally to eat plants as fresh as possible, you know, after they've been exposed to wavelengths of light from the sun, after they've been kind of, you know, supercharged, so to speak, with energy from the planet and from the sun, you know, and exposed to negative ions outside and all this type of thing. But there's also this concept that you, to a certain extent, want to actually protect plants from excessive light. Can you get into how light, whether, you know, too much light or too little light, affects the energy of the food?
Yeah, that's a pretty complicated subject, and I can't say I'm an expert on that. There's some interesting research on different plants that some of them have higher, you know, phytonutrients, antioxidants, if you eat them right away, and some of them have, if you leave them, say, sitting out for 12 hours, some of them, if you put them in the refrigerator. And yeah, I'm trying to incorporate all that information, A, in my life, and B, in our making of these powders.
Well, when I bought like powders from you, for example, they came in very dark jars. Like I think you call them Myron jars.
Yes.
Can you explain why that is?
Yeah, and it's crucial to what you're just saying and to making this viable, because the problem was, so we, for instance, will take kale, and kale to me does the best if you process it right away and if you blanch it or steam it for about 1 to 3 minutes first, which breaks down the cellulose and makes it the nutrients more bioavailable. So the first step is blanch it and or steam it, and then right away we dehydrate it. And then right away after it's dehydrated, we put it into I'm not sure the pronunciation exactly. Some people say Myron and some people say Myron jar. And these were jars that seemingly have been around since the pyramids. That's at least the urban myth, where they found oil in them that was actually fresh after thousands of years. And then this Swiss company reverse engineered them. And they're deep purple at a certain thickness, and they only let very specific wavelengths of light in, especially UVA. And the story is that, therefore, not only do things not degrade in there, but they get more energized the longer they stay in the jar. Now, we decided, you know, you can't believe anything, so let's test it out. So last year, we put two identical, more or less, cherry tomatoes, one in a mason jar and one in a mirin jar, and just put it on the counter in our kitchen. And in 2 months, the one in the mason jar was all mush and, you know, moldy, etc. And in 6 months, the one in the mirin jar, you could still eat it.
I actually saw a photo of that on your website, and the one that's in the glass jar, just the regular glass jar. Which, frankly, like a lot of people listening in know, you're not supposed to store stuff in plastic, and so they store it in like these mason glass jars. But the tomato in the glass jar, it almost looks rotten, and the tomato in this mirin, almost like a violet black type of glass, it seems to be like a plump fresh red tomato. You mentioned that that's because the Myron light lets in the UVA rays. And I think it also lets in infrared rays.
Yeah.
And so that's somehow blocking excessive UVB radiation or excessive wavelengths of light that might cause something to age more excessively.
Exactly. It blocks out the UVB and the UVC, which are the degeneration aging frequencies. And so it basically, I don't know if this is exactly true, but our hope is the longer you keep it in a mirror and jar, the better it gets. I have things that I've now had in a mirror and jar, like mint powder or horseradish powder, or that smell exactly the same as the day that we put them in the jar, maybe not quite as strong, but now some powders, the smell goes away after a while. Some powders seem to just stay there for years. And so that was a really key part of me being behind doing vegetable powders, because if they're not in a mirror and jar, they're not worth doing.
Now, what about whether or not the vegetable specifically has been cooked versus whether it's raw? What's your take on that? Because I'll hear a lot of times folks will say, well, don't eat raw vegetables because they're more difficult on your digestive system. Other people will say that cooking will reduce the nutrient density of the vegetable. What's your take on the whole raw versus cooked debate when it comes to eating plants?
So the thing that I believe in most deeply is my own experience of taste and smell of the food. I think it's fine to do nutrient analysis, et cetera, but I want to eat the food that looks the best, tastes the best, and smells the best. So the cooked versus raw is dependent on the vegetable. So, for instance, kale, if you eat raw kale versus if you blanch it for about a minute or two, it gets greener and sweeter because it's breaking down the cellulose and making the nutrients. So I guess I wouldn't say never, but I have no interest in eating raw kale. All the kale I would eat would be cooked for a minute or two to break it down so that it's more available. So that's how we do the powders.
And you said that you blanch it. What do you mean blanching? Just for people who don't do that.
You put it in boiling water for about a minute or so.
Okay, got it. Then you just take it out and then you would prepare it in a smoothie or a powder or whatever you're going to make with it.
Yes.
Okay.
Similarly, I'm not interested in eating. It doesn't taste good. It doesn't smell good. But baked pumpkin is wonderful. It's
love baked pumpkin. So
that's how we prepare the pumpkin powder. Now there are some vegetables, like I wouldn't cook lettuce, because lettuce doesn't have much cellulose and it doesn't need to be cooked, and so there's no point in cooking it.
I don't know, man. You ever barbecued like a romaine lettuce with some salt and black pepper?
I know what you mean.
Yeah. Or a grilled lettuce, I guess it would be like barbecue grilled lettuce. Yeah,
right. There are sophisticated. Yeah, that's a good point. But generally speaking, so you know, like leeks are better raw for us. The smell is better. The taste is better. Tomatoes are raw. Peppers are low heat. But the greens are all cooked, blanched, or steamed. Pumpkins, squash. Carrots are better cooked a little bit. So it totally depends on getting to know your vegetable. It's like getting to know a different child. You have to know carrots do best. Carrots and beets definitely like to be cooked.
So tell me about these vegetable powders that you're talking about, how you actually make them and why you actually put the vegetables into a powder. And then I'm also curious how you actually use them, because I got some of these vegetable powders from you, and you know, with the Ashitaba and the Okinawan spinach and some of these other things in like a dry powdered form. But it was really the first time that I'd seen them, and I had some friends over actually and had them out on the table, and they were kind of scratching their heads too in terms of like, you know, how are these vegetable powders actually made, and how does one use them?
So they're made by, so the process is we either grow them ourselves, and you know, we use you know, way beyond organic techniques. So some of them we grow ourselves. We use the, you know, the oldest, best varieties, but actually not always the oldest, because in our tomato salt, there's an indigo apple tomato. And the reason I chose that is A, it tastes like bacon, and B, it has the highest lycopene content of any tested tomatoes.
The tomato tastes like bacon?
A little bit.
Interesting.
It's a little stretch, but that's its reputation. And you definitely has a tomato bacony kind of thing going there. Anyway, so we choose the varieties. So we either grow them or we source them from local, you know, Northern California organic farms. And then we do one. So the idea is, you know, a person out there can't get all this diversity, so we're going to provide it for them, help them. Not that they're not supposed to eat fresh vegetables, because they are, but this adds to the diversity. So we take whatever it is, kale, we harvest it, blanch it, dehydrate it, powder it, put it into mirin jars. Pumpkins, we bake them. You know, we use these Hopi blue pumpkins. We use other heirloom varieties, bake them, dehydrate them, grind them, put it into mirin jars. So, and et cetera. Ashitaba is raw because that brings out the flavor the best, just dehydrated, ground, put into mirin jars.
So you could theoretically, not to put you out of business, because I know you make these vegetable powders, and it sounds like you've got the process down to a science, but you could theoretically, or I could have taken like the nettles and the mint and the plantain that I just talked about. I could have taken that back, put it into my wife's food dehydrator, dehydrated it at low temperature, and then put it into like a Vitamix, and then I could put it into jars and actually have like a dehydrated powder like this.
Absolutely. In fact, if you put it into mirin jars, that would be a great thing to do. And you would have, so the next day, if it's just, you come to making your salad and, oh, we just don't have time to go forage in the woods. You put, you know, a quarter of a teaspoon of that powder with those three into your salad dressing. And now you've eaten, instead of three vegetables with lettuce, tomatoes, and radishes, you've now had six.
Okay, so I'm looking at for example, like your threefold blend powder, and that one has carrots and leeks. So you've got the roots of the upside down human. It's got Swiss chard and kale. So you've got the leaves slash stems of the upside down human, and then you've got bell peppers and zucchini in there, which I guess would be like the fruits or the parts that would be good for your reproductive or your metabolic system. So that's kind of cool how you've worked in those three components. But in this powder, let's say I were to sprinkle like a teaspoon of this powder onto a salad or on a soup or a stew or something like that. How much of the actual vegetable would be in like a teaspoon or a tablespoon? Are we talking about getting like a whole salad in one spoonful, or how much can you squeeze into one of these little 4 ounce jars?
Yeah. So, you know, not only do we have all the parts, but we did it partly for flavor, but also partly for color. So we have red vegetables, green vegetables, white vegetables, and multicolored vegetables all in there with all the, you know, antioxidants and phytonutrients that implies. And so we're still trying to get exact numbers, but if you take like four large stalks of kale, that's about a teaspoon of kale powder. So if you take a one zucchini, that's about a quarter or so of a teaspoon of zucchini powder. One large beet is about a half to three quarters of a teaspoon of beet powder. So the other thing about diversity is if you're going to eat 15 vegetables a day, we're not talking about like a huge big bowl of kale or romaine lettuce. That's not how traditional people did it. They ate small amounts of a lot of different ones. So in that, say, teaspoon of threefold blend, you get a significant serving of all the nutrients in the leeks and in the beets and in the kale and in the chard and in the zucchini and in the bell peppers.
So you're getting that huge amount of plant variety that you were talking about earlier that our ancestors would have eaten.
Yes. One teaspoon, and you know, you use it, you can sprinkle it over over fish to make you know, broiled fish with threefold blend.
Mm-hmm.
But you can put it in soup, you can put it in salad dressing.
Yeah, I've been putting the leek salt in my smoothie. And then here's the cool thing. My wife is a popcorn fanatic.
Yes.
And she actually, so when she has her popcorn now, she's got carrots, beet, kale, Swiss chard, winter squash, and zucchini all as part of the popcorn because she's sprinkling the powder on top of the popcorn.
Exactly. That's exactly how we meant to do this.
Cool. I like it. And so these are all prepared using some of the methods that you've just described in terms of going into the marin jars. They stay potent for a long period of time because they're blocking out the UVB light, but allowing the UVA and the infrared light in. And then you just basically pick your poison and put it on a smoothie, stew, scrambled eggs, popcorn, potatoes, whatever you want to put it on.
Yeah, I'm not sure I like the word poison.
pick your product.
Yeah, you pick. We're hoping to branch out, and so we're going to offer something called Choya Buds, which is a Native American bud from a cactus that's a wild food that's dried that you can rehydrate and put in stir fries. So it's all about nori powder, which is a wild seaweed.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about I want to eat 20 vegetables a day, but I don't want to spend 2.5 hours every morning chopping nori.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I love it. And of course your book goes into a lot more detail. Although what I want to do now after talking with you is read this other book, The Fourfold Path to Healing. But for those of you listening in, I'll put a link to this Fourfold Path of Healing book, but also the shorter, easy to read version that I initially read, which got me inspired to get Tom on the show today, called How and Why to Eat More Vegetables. And I'll put a link to these books along with these vegetable powders that we've been talking about over in the show notes. And you can access those here. Go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/eatmorevegetables. That's bengreenfieldfitness.com/eatmorevegetables. And when you go there, what I'll do is link over to all the different vegetable powders, as well as some of the other things that we talked about today, such as biodynamic wine and anthroposophic medicine, and even the 2016 Weston A. Price Conference, where Tom and I are both going to be speaking. I'll be speaking on how athletes can fuel themselves in a more ancestral way. What are you going to be talking about, Tom?
I'll be talking about the heart.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I have your book about the heart right here. The other book that hopefully I'm going to get a chance to interview you about later on this year, because that one also blew my mind and is also only about 100 pages long, amazingly. So I think you have things figured out, by the way. Rather, like I write 400 to 500 page books, and you write these little information dense packed books that seem like they'd be a little bit less of a chore to churn out, but that still have a lot of really good information in them. So,
well, thank you. Yes,
I love it. And I'll link to all these books in the show notes for those of you listening in. Go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/eatmorevegetables. Tom, thanks for coming on and sharing all this stuff with us.
Thank you for having me, Ben. It's been great to talk to you.
If people aren't inspired to eat more plants and eat more vegetables now, then I really don't know what to say. We're just going to have to start figuring out how to make vegetable smoothies taste like Big Macs, I guess. But at least we've got tomatoes that taste like bacon, right?
Yeah, try an indigo apple tomato. They're hard to find, but they have a definite bacony flavor.
It's officially now on my bucket list. I'll do it. All right, folks. Well, this is Ben Greenfield along with Dr. Thomas Cowan signing out from bengreenfieldfitness.com. Have a healthy week.
You've been listening to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. Go to bengreenfieldfitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness and performance advice.